This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at acura.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Bredeser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week, Alan Arkin was nominated for an Academy Award for his first feature film in 1966. 40 years later, there's Oscar buzz about his role in Little Miss Sunshine. Then, we talk to the producing partners to the stars. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. It's a remarkable development for a company that until recently had a massive promotional deal with McDonald's. But the Walt Disney Company said last week that it would stop using its characters to shill heart-clogging fast food. They've also pledged to upgrade the food at their theme parks, replacing unhealthy snacks like French fries and soda with veggies and fruit juice. By 2009, Disney will limit portion sizes at its parks and in most cases refuse to tie its brand to packaged foods that get more than 30% of their calories from fat, more than 10% from saturated fat, or more than 10% from added sugar. Sources inside Disney say the changes were spurred by Winnie the Pooh's recent disclosure that he has adult-onset diabetes. In other big business news stories, NBC Universal announced last week it aims to slash operating expenses by $750 million by the end of next year, mostly by cutting 5% of its news and entertainment workforce around the world. Known inside the company as NBCU 2.0, the plan is supposed to return the unit to double-digit growth. How will you experience the changes? Most likely by seeing more of Howie Mandel's bald pate. NBC Universal has decided to stop scheduling expensive dramas and comedies during the 8 to 9 o'clock time period, concentrating instead on cheapy game shows like Deal or No Deal and reality programming. NBC has also pledged to stop ordering in so much takeout. The network, along with sister channels USA, Sci-Fi, and Bravo, will get more shows from NBC Universal's in-house production studio. Owning shows outright means more money from online revenue, an area where the network will actually boost spending by $150 million. Those laid off from NBC might consider buying a few dogs. Fox News reported last week that when the Jack Russell Terrier, known to viewers of the hit TV comedy Frasier as Eddie, passed away last June, he left a $3 million estate. For your information, in-demand dogs can make real money, $100 to $500 per day for still photography shoots, $500 to $1,500 for TV commercials, and roughly $50,000 for a major pet commercial for the biggest brands. We don't have an exact figure on how much Eddie made per episode on Frasier, but suffice it to say, he didn't have to eat dog food in his old age. Speaking of animals on video, the BBC reported last week that Disney has punished staff at its French theme park for besmirching the character of Disney's beloved characters. A number of Paris Disney employees dressed up in costumes to take part in a joke video wherein they simulated sex. The short film, which of course ended up on YouTube, is said to feature Mickey and Minnie Mouse with Goofy in a menage a trois and other compromising positions. Finally, in foreign affairs news, Reuters reported last week that the authorities in Kazakhstan are terrified that the Ali G show character Borat has permanently stained their nation as an enclave of fermented horse urine drinking misogynistic anti-Semites. So, the Kazakh Foreign Ministry has invited the British comedian who plays the character to come and visit and see the nation for himself. This is, of course, patently ridiculous. No one could mistake Sacha Baron Cohen as someone who is desperate enough to drink fermented horse urine and who harbors virulent hatred for the Jews. That's not Borat. That's Mel Gibson. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later on the show, stars and the producing partners who work with them. But next, Alan Arkin hates the business. That's show business, not this show. I don't think he hates the show. Alan Arkin started his showbiz career in a rather uncharacteristic way. As a recorder-playing, guitar-strumming, cardigan-wearing, folk-song-singing member of the mid-50s group The Terriers. You know The Terriers. Their version of the Banana Boat song made it to number 4 on the charts. He went on to help found the venerated Second City Improv Troupe, and when Arkin finally made it to the big screen, he made a big splash, earning an Oscar nomination for Best Actor for The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. Now, exactly 40 years later, Fox Searchlight is frothing up the Oscar buzz for his performance in Little Miss Sunshine.
Grandpa?
What?
I don't want to be a loser.
You're not a loser. Where'd you get the idea you're a loser?
Because Dad hates losers.
Whoa. Back up a minute. You know what a loser is? A real loser is somebody that's so afraid of not winning, they don't even try. Now, you're trying, right?
Yeah.
Well, then you're not a loser. We're going to have fun tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
We can tell them all to go to hell.
It's not like Arkin hasn't been busy since he made his first feature in 1966. He's appeared in a ridiculously long list of films and television, performed on Broadway, and directed films, theater, TV programs, and commercials. Mr. Arkin was kind enough to join us in our studios in Santa Monica, where we got to chat.
Is this
the interview? I did a Mike Wallace interview once about 35 years ago.
Yeah.
And I walked into the room and he started talking to me like this, and then about 8 minutes later, he said, well, goodbye. I said, when is the interview? He said, we did it.
No, we'll give it. I'll shoot a flare gun, and that'll be it.
I have to start my interesting. I got to get my interesting tone of voice.
Well, that's what Kissinger said, right? That's the great thing about being famous is that you don't have to be interesting. Everyone thinks they're boring.
Oh yeah, really?
Yeah. So says Kissinger. Who knows?
So says Kissinger. Yeah. He lied about other things.
Well, here we are.
It's my job to lie.
Are we ready to go, Matt? Okay. Alan Arkin, welcome to the business.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're one of the few people, a handful of people.
I think maybe the only one.
Maybe the only one. No, in fact, there's six. But who was nominated for their very first performance on film, feature film. Orson Welles, I think Lawrence Tippett was in there.
Lawrence Tippett?
Tippett, yourself, a few others. And now here we are again, some 40 years later. Is it weird?
No weirder than anything else that's happened to me in the business. There's a kind of an intimation in there that I have another a nomination in the bag.
Well, look, studios act a certain way when they think a performance is going to possibly bring home hardware. And let's say, I'll be honest with you, Fox Searchlight is acting that way. They're getting behind you.
Well, that's nice.
They're schlepping you around. They're making you talk to guys like me.
I came out here to be with my grandson.
Oh, that's nice. That's merely an ancillary benefit. That's not why you're alive. You're not here to interact with humans or have meaningful interpersonal relationships. You're here to win Oscars. Kidding aside, I'm curious. Let's say I don't want to be presumptive here, but I mean you did a hell of a performance in this movie. A lot of people say you may get a nomination. Certainly the studio would like for you to be nominated. They're mounting the machinations that get mounted when these things kick into gear. I'd like to sort of get your take on that. How has Hollywood changed? And how does the awards process
Well, I don't live
change?
Here. I've never lived here, so I don't really know how it's changed. The only thing I can say is that the thing that excites me more than anything, apart from that initial thing when you get a part that's really exciting, there's a moment of yippee, and then the work starts again. But the thing that gratifies me the most about having been in the business for 65 years are those rare times when you feel like you have really created a family and everybody's doing exactly the same thing for the same reason. And people talk about that all the time, but it really doesn't happen that much. I find that in the 60s that did happen much more. People would hang together. There would be more rehearsals. Now I just feel much less camaraderie. Everybody runs to their trailer and they're on their cell phones again. And it saddens me. I feel kind of lonely for the most part when I'm on a set because I don't feel any sense of that any sense of continuity is being built up particularly.
Well, I ask about the Oscar stuff not to blow smoke up your butt or anything, but because I'm
– Hey, wait a minute. We're on national radio
here. This is national public radio.
You just said something.
I said but.
Oh, okay.
I'm interested in how – Oscar buzz or an Oscar nomination or, please God, an Oscar win for you.
It's going to change my life?
It's going to change your career.
And
might it allow you to do things you
haven't gotten to do yet. That you,
like what?
I don't know. That's
what
for
haven't
you
I
to
gotten
tell.
To do yet? Could I play the young Beethoven? I don't have a lot of aspirations anymore, to tell you the truth. I don't know what they're going to – I don't know what they can possibly offer me now that I haven't – I don't want to – my idea –
More dough?
More dough would be good. I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah.
For a couple of movies. But my greatest aspiration, I scream at my agents and my managers. I want to be in front of a blue screen and I want to be saying, look out for the thing. It's coming. No foreign languages anymore. I don't want any long speeches anymore.
No soliloquies. No.
I don't want to kill myself anymore. I want to – like to paraphrase one of my heroes, Jean Renoir, who said – he said for many, many years, he says, I had a great message to give the world. He says, now I just want to send people my love. And that was somewhere around halfway through his career. He realized nobody was getting the message anyway. He'd do great movies and people would pick at the theaters. Until 20 years later when they realized they were masterpieces. I don't have an enormous amount of aspirations anymore. I'm happy to walk through my day and enjoy the day. Carpe diem.
No, but you're not just sort of retiring to some pleasure dome here. I mean, my understanding, and you can
– I can't afford a pleasure dome.
I'm Club Professor Ackner, and you're listening to The Business. Alan Arkin's been in show business for 50-plus years – but his real passion these days are creativity workshops. Born out of his own desire for self-improvement, Arkin uses the improv techniques he developed during his Second City days to help people get to a place of creative honesty and emotional openness. Alas, this is a show about the business of show business, so somewhat against his will, I dragged him back to the pedestrian subject of managers and agents.
Well, I got off the phone with my manager, Estelle Lasher, about half an hour ago, and I told her I feel incredibly fortunate because I feel like everybody who is working with me now is absolutely trustworthy and in my corner, and I feel totally safe, maybe for the first time in my life. I love my agent, I love my manager, and I love my lawyer, and I feel safe so that I can go about my business and not concern my not, I'm in a position where I feel like I don't have to concern myself with the business. I go about living my life, and I let them take care of the things that they know how to do. And
what happened in the past that made you feel otherwise, unsafe?
I don't know. It wasn't.
I'm less interested in names and more interested in anecdotes.
It's basically I didn't know what they were doing.
Didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I felt like I've been with a couple of people over the years who would revel in telling me stories of how they tricked people into doing certain things. And I would laugh thinking how great my representation was. And then one day I woke up and I said, hey, wait a minute. If they're doing that, if they're playing mind games with other people and tricking people into thinking things are going on and they're not – what's to say that they're not doing that with me?
I'm interested in how long you were with these people. I mean, how long did it take you to?
Well, I never lived in Hollywood since I was in my teens, and it's something I never paid any attention. And it's one of the reasons I gave up directing. I spent a lot of time. I directed a film. I got spectacular reviews for it, and then I tried to get another movie organized and realized it took several years of my life. Years of my life went into getting a couple of projects done.
This is in 93 or?
Before that. Right. I spent 20 years trying to get this one film done that was an absolute labor of love of mine. I loved everything about this movie. I would have done it free. I was in a place – I had the money five times. Three times I gave it up because I found out where the money came from. I didn't want to have anything to do with those people. And
was it like arms dealers or what?
Yes, like in that area.
Right.
And then there was
– I was kidding.
No, but I walked into some guy's office and there's pornographic films on the wall. I said, thanks a lot. I don't care what your aspirations are with this film. It's not going to come out the way I want it. That happened five times, and then I finally said, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to be a businessman. I don't want to be a producer. I want to act, and I want to direct. And if it means spending 6 years of my life, 5 years of my life, getting stuff organized to direct something for 3 months, I'm not a director. I'm just like a part-time director. I'm a businessman the rest of the time. I didn't want to do it, so I gave it up, and I'm a lot happier for it. So you, what you want to talk about is something I know nothing about and don't even really want to know that much about.
Here's what
so
I'd
let's like, talk about something.
Let's talk about something. Here's what I'd like to ask you. Yeah. On the movies that you worked on, I mean, I think you were quoted as saying about Little Miss Sunshine that you had no idea this movie would be anything.
No, that's not exactly true. I you mean commercial? Maybe commercial.
Commercially, yeah.
Whoever knows? Nobody ever knows anything about that. I mean, you make if they did, everything would be a hit. I knew the script was sensational when I read it. Mm-hmm. That I had no question about. I had misgivings about the directors because they never – number one, I mean, there were a lot of red flags. They had never directed a film before. That's
they were
one
from the commercial world, yeah.
Yeah. Number two, it was a husband and wife. It was two people who were going to direct the film. This is a second red flag. Number three, they're married. There's a big third red flag. And within 2 days of shooting, it was clear that all the anxieties were unfounded, that they were just wonderful, wonderful to work with.
And that family sense you said is so lacking in so many films these days.
Yeah. It was.
Did the cast gel, I guess?
Very much so, yeah. Everybody was on the same page for the entire shoot.
Are there movies that you thought would be something and weren't?
Oh, God, yeah. There's a whole period. Well, I got – what I've learned to do in the past, I guess, 15 years was something I think everybody should do, every actor should do when they get hired for film, is I will not make a movie now unless I have a long talk with the director beforehand and find out what their vision of the movie is and whether our visions coincide or whether his visions is more exciting than mine. It's fine. I'm willing to go along with somebody else's vision as long as I get excited by it and feel like it's something I can jump into. But I like to present my absolute most arbitrary worst side before the movie starts so that we know exactly where we stand. There's no surprises.
It can only get better from there.
Yeah. I got fired from a movie once in my career. The studio – I don't even mind talking about it if you want to hear about it.
Yeah, I'd love to.
It was on – the funny thing was I got canned from Bonfire of the Vanities.
It's a good movie to get canned from the way it turned out.
Yeah, and it turned out I was the only one who got good reviews as a result of that. I kept getting mentioned in the fact that I was wise not to be in. But they fired me. Because the movie got the script got picked up. I think it was by the NAACP. I'm not sure what, but it was some huge black organization that felt that blacks were being treated very badly in the film. So the studio got nervous about that, and they started combing the script to find out what character they could turn into a positive character and make him black. So they fired me and got Morgan Freeman instead. They didn't want me to begin with. But I read the part and I said, that's my part. Once every 50 years or so, you get a part, you read a script and you say, this is my part. I knew that was my part. So I did. I said, I'm going to send in a tape doing the entire part and have them and all get hired, which is exactly what happened. I did the whole part on tape. They saw the tape, hired me, and then the next week fired me because of creative differences, according to the newspapers.
How often have you done that? That's amazing.
I never did it before or since, but I knew it was my part.
Mm-hmm.
And Morgan Freeman knew it was his
part. What do you think of his part?
I didn't think he did it. I think he's a wonderful actor, but I didn't think he got any juice out of it.
We've been talking with Alan Arkin, director, producer, actor, Broadway guy.
Grandfather,
and hopefully Oscar nominee once again. Alan Arkin, thanks for being on The Business.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you.
Alan Arkin didn't want to deal with the business aspects of the business. After a short break, we'll talk to the partners of two stars that do. You're listening to The Business from NPR. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business. To keep their stars happy,
The studios often give them a bungalow on the lot, some cash for overhead, and a promise to look at their ideas. These arrangements are often referred to as vanity deals for obvious reasons. But many stars have become serious producers, controlling their own careers and making successful films that others star in. Drew Barrymore's Flower films and Tom Cruise's Cruise Wagner productions are two good examples. But what of the Wagner in Cruise Wagner? Or Drew Barrymore's partner, Nancy Juvonen? We went to the West Hollywood offices of Nicolas Cage's production company, Saturn Films, to talk to Norm Golightly, Nick's producing partner. We were joined by Grant Heslov, George Clooney's partner in Smokehouse, his production company.
What is the difference, really, between being a producer for a star versus being, quote-unquote, just a producer? Norm, I mean, do you want to go first on that?
Certainly when companies like these start out, they agencies and screenwriters will oftentimes look at them as clearinghouses for a way to get material to that star. And in our case, one of the other reasons Nick started the company was it's just simply a love of film and wanting to be involved in all aspects of film production, but not necessarily as an actor.
Grant, you kind of giggled when he said the word clearinghouse.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, there's X amount of people that get a film made, X amount of movie stars. And so, if you can get one of these people to be in your film, you have a chance of getting your film made, which is understandable. Everybody who's here wants to get a film made. And so often you can't get through the agent and you can't get through the lawyer. And so you try to get through, the company or the producing partner or whatever you want to call it. And so, we have five or six assistants out there and I hear them all saying all day long, I'm really sorry we can't take unsolicited submissions. And, there are hundreds of calls a week.
Initially, I think a lot of these companies, that's how they're viewed by the community externally. But once you go on to do other things and, when you make movies, when the principal of that company isn't in them, then they actually start to give you credit for being legitimate producers and you start seeing a larger variety of material. It's not only about having that star in it.
Grant, do you buy that there's that perception? And do you think that perception is the case? And also, if you could talk a little bit about what the reality you think it is.
I think that is the perception in a lot of cases. I know in our case it's a little bit different in that George and I write together and that we've produced a lot of stuff that George isn't in and a lot of smaller films as well.
And it changes over time. I think the one of the problems with these types of companies is in most cases they don't last. It's very fashionable, or it has been in the past, for actors to have their own production companies. But after two or three or 4 years, a lot of those companies come and go, and you see which stars like George and Nick and certainly others out there who are serious about having companies stick with them. And I think those ones become viable over the long run. And I think that's one of the other digs on these types of companies is that you have to really earn your credibility and your stripes for a bit before people take you seriously.
Yeah, they call them vanity deals, I guess, for some people. And a lot of times the deals are put in place by the studios so to keep these guys and gals happy, which is understandable. And sometimes people develop with them, and sometimes they don't do a whole lot with them.
It has to be. I mean, I think it helps that you both have known your respective stars as long as you have. But the reality is that these guys can't really walk down the street without, causing traffic accidents.
Oh, George and I just got back from a location scout. We were scouting in North and South Carolina for the next film that we're doing. And, doing a location scout normally is a very easy, simple thing. But with George, it's a whole, every stop is a photo op and a thing. It's amazing.
Describe.
Normally, when you go on a location scout, you'll meet with, let's say it's an office building, you meet with the manager of the office. But not always will they show up with their kids and their wife and, the whole gang just happen to be there.
Norm Golightly?
During Nick's first experience directing this little independent movie called Sunny, we shot on location in New Orleans, which, before Katrina, this was years ago, and New Orleans is a city that Nick and I both love, but they're very restricted about what you can film there and when you can film there, and there was a very specific window in Nick's schedule when we could do this movie, and it happened to overlap with Mardi Gras and the Super Bowl being in the city, and we wanted to shoot a lot of the movie right there in the quarter, and basically Nick was told that you know, it's difficult to do these things down here, you know, but if you maybe if you were the king of Mardi Gras, if you were King Bacchus, and you do all the, you know, ride the float on the parade and wear these costumes and things this year, we could probably help you out with your filming down here. And thus began Nick's reign as King Bacchus for whatever year that was, Mardi Gras. And they very much insisted that he do that to have a happy, friendly filmmaking experience down there in Louisiana.
It's weird. You wouldn't imagine down in New Orleans, you know, sort of back-channel deal-making being done like that.
It's not a state that's known for that sort of thing. It's very above board. Is one headache where you're trying to make a movie happen and, you know, perhaps the studio in question or the backers in question say, oh, great, you know, well, George Clooney starring in the movie. Then, you know, you're saying, well, no, George just wants to produce this. He likes the script. He doesn't really think it's something for him to star in.
Yes.
Is there sort of that,
Yeah, I mean, interest? You know, people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When Grant or I call, the hope is probably there that our guys will be starring in the film. And then there's, you know, the secondary, well, why don't they want to? Is there something wrong with it?
They, you know, they seemingly now they could be full of, you know, and it could be all a ploy to get to the guy that I work with. That can always be the case. But no, I feel, you know, in my case is a little different because of the writing. You know, I don't know what Norm's situation is like, but
no. I think going back to that image of, oh, you're so and so's guy. Again, I think it goes with the life of the company in that when they are these kind of overnight ventures that come and go, then there's the danger of being that person. But when the relationship is such a long term one, and there's a lot of product coming out of that, I think people start to respect the collaboration and what each individual brings to that partnership.
Are you ever in fear for your job if you were to sort of say, look, you're out of your mind on this one, man. You just can't do this. Can you say that? I mean,
I can. Yeah. I mean, I think that's why it works well between us, because, you know, I knew him well before he was a star. I knew him when he used to, you know, sleep on my couch, and I'd loaned him $100 so he could get his first headshots. We have sort of a deal that we both have to agree on. We have to agree on the project before we go forward with it. If one of us doesn't, and then we each get a buy for the year. So that's the way it works.
Meaning
for us.
No questions asked. Look, this is my chit, and I'm using it right here.
Yeah, you know, George, he could think that I'm absolutely insane to want to do a ballet set in the, you know, in Stalin Russia. But if something
you're
I want to do.
You're doing one too? Oh, no. No, I think in our case, it was the results are the same, but the beginnings were opposite in that Nick and I didn't know each other before our business interaction. And the reason I think partially that he chose me is that I am direct and I am honest. Yeah, it gets a little sweaty once in a while, of course, just like it does with anybody you'd be arguing with, whether it's a friend or a business partner. But, you know, the results are generally good, and I think that ability to do that is only a positive thing.
Grant Haseloff, Norm Golightly, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com. Just click on KCRW A to Z. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.